My personal list of discussion questions is now in someone else's hands, which is great. But I'm just going to open it up. Comments, questions, angry tirades. Sam?
Daniel, I was running around doing recreation stuff, and I missed most, not more than half of your lecture, but I heard you say that marriage has sacramental significance.
Mm-hmm.
My Roman Catholic alarm went off. They call it a
I'm not a Roman Catholic.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to recreation.
No.
What do you mean by that?
So sacraments are physical things with spiritual meaning. And I think I'm using it with a lowercase s. Marriage is not a sacrament, to be clear. But there is something deep, unifying, speaking of God, speaking of the relationship between Christ and the Paul uses the term. I think he uses the term mysterios when he says this is a great mystery, but I'm saying that it's about Christ and the church. So maybe that's a little bit of a landmine there, but I do think Paul actually uses that language, speaking of man and woman coming together and being one flesh. He says, this is a great mystery. The word, mysterios in Greek winds up getting translated as sacramentum in Latin. So I think it's an appropriate thing. It's a mysterious thing. Maybe that would be a less fraught way of putting it. But it is a mystery that speaks of something far beyond itself. So you're not just seeing, isn't it amazing that the two become one flesh? It is amazing that the two become one flesh, but it's even more amazing that it speaks of this incredible cosmic love that God has for his people. That is a mystery. And in that sense, I say it's sacramental. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Esther? What that choosing singleness looks like.
Yeah,
I think that there are people who look at themselves and look at the tasks that God has given them in the world and say, I think I can happily, I can joyfully, faithfully serve my God best if I remain unmarried. And that's a big decision. And I'm maybe overstating it slightly. There are people who will want to get married and who will never get married. But I think that we don't do a good job as Christian churches. I think at this point, we've moved to being so afraid of pushing marriage on people. We're going to all have different experiences from different ends, right? We're going to have been in churches where marriage was pushed. And we're going to have been, some of us will have been in churches where marriage was just never discussed, it was just always assumed, and there wasn't sort of honest, very realistic talk about connecting people to each other so that people who want to get married can get married. One of the things that I do appreciate, I sort of slammed the Reformation a little bit for overemphasizing marriage, but one of the results of their sort of recovery of marriage as a way to honor God is that they were extremely matter of fact about connecting people to get them married. So there's there's this one character named, what was her name? Woodbrandis Rosenblatt. She was married to four major reformers.
Made
me wonder if she started knocking them off for the insurance money, but she was this incredible, strong, had great character woman who was married to like four significant reformers in Europe. The church was just very straightforward about that. I think when we aren't straightforward about marriage, then we don't give people the chance to discern whether they're called to a godly singleness in the long term. I think you need to have both of those things. And if you do have a situation, if you do have churches where we can probably find you somebody, if you really want to get married, we can probably help you with that, then the people who are saying, you know what, I think I don't want to get married, they can have a clear conversation with others and in their own hearts and come to that conclusion without it being without there being any shadow of poor so-and-so couldn't find anybody. I want our churches to not be places where poor so-and-so couldn't find anybody. I'd rather that they were places where so-and-so is such an excellent woman or such an excellent man. He or she decided not to get married so that they could serve on the mission field better, or they could serve in this way better, they could serve in this other profession. Or they just decided this was not the best thing for them and they could serve the Lord in other ways. But does that answer the question at all? Heather?
Follow that up just really quick with what I was saying a little bit yesterday about asking questions. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that I have experienced in the church, not just personally but others, you know, is people assume because of your state, because you're single or because you don't have children as a couple or things like that, they start making assumptions and they say stupid and hurtful things based on those assumptions with a good heart. So I just encourage asking questions before making assumptions.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very good advice. And we don't like to do that very much, do we? We really, it's weird. We kind of default to, I risk being offensive in making this statement, but
then you're
I'm offensive. Trying to avoid, while trying to avoid being offensive in asking this question. And it is a lot of times, you need to have a little bit of courage and just ask people questions.
Yeah. Why is north and east of Musa Dah unavailable, and how did you find it?
I got one of like 3 old copies that were left on Amazon for under $1,000. It's just out of print. It's just it's an old book. It's out of print. We actually talked about reprinting it at Crown and Covenant, but it's kind of an idiosyncratic old book. It wouldn't be a good idea for us to reprint it. Somebody say something?
I was going to say,
Mark.
Check your church libraries.
Yeah.
If you've got half a good RP church library, it's probably in there somewhere.
Yeah, check your church libraries if you're in an old RP church.
when was
if you're in my church, there is no church library.
I've got a couple copies of it.
Wow. Mark England probably has a couple copies of it. Sitting on a gold mine. Bonnie, go ahead with what you're saying. By the way, remind me, I've been asked to repeat things so that the microphone picks it up, so if you ask me a question, remind me to repeat it. Did that answer your question? I'm sure that there are people in this room who own a copy, but it'd be really hard to buy one off the internet right now. Nathan?
Just to follow up on that, if you can find a copy and you don't want to read it, but you like aesthetics, it's actually a very beautiful book, too, which hasn't historically happened in RP publications.
Yeah.
I mean, historically, we've gone cheap rather than beautiful.
Yeah, North and East of Musa Dah is a beautiful hardback book with these fantastic illustrations that were done by, I think, Evangeline Matheny's brother. And she is an amazing character. She is an amazing character. Should I tell a story? All right. Here's an Evangeline Matheny character. Evangeline Matheny was, speaking of single women who, you know, decided to serve the Lord as unmarried people, she was on the mission field for something like 40 or 50 years. She grew up in the Syrian mission field and never married. I'm trying to remember if she was a doctor or if she was like a teacher and administrator primarily. I think she was a teacher and administrator primarily. She was nicknamed Polyglot Matheny. She spoke like 9 languages fluently. And she was just really, really tough and tender at the same time. So there's one story about when they were dealing with an influx of Armenian refugees during the genocide, and she and some others were trying to manage a food distribution, and she was keeping the crowd of Armenian refugees, starving Armenian refugees who were there for food, in line with a bullwhip. And the British missionaries who were around saw this and said, "This isn't Christian love. How can you justify this?" And she said, "All right, we'll do it your way." Well, the next day there was a stampede and three people were killed. So the next day after that, they went back to Evangeline Matheny and her bullwhip. This is a woman who, at the same time, has written these just incredibly tender, beautifully written accounts of life in the Middle East. They're not about missions, but they're about life among the Muslims, and especially, and also the Greek Orthodox in Syria at the time, early 20th century. Howard.
You're saying a beautiful rendition of Matchmaker. How active should the church be in looking after its singles in terms of both asking good questions and figuring things out, but actually moving into that role of matchmaking?
I think that the church should be, on an individual basis, quite active. In the role of matchmakers, that's what the question is about. How much should the church get involved in that? I think to what Heather was saying a few minutes ago, assumptions hurt a lot more than questions do. And if I over and over again, and I hope this doesn't step on anybody's toes, but I've thought when I go to the international conference or I go to this or I hear about this or that, I thought I would really hate to go to a singles mixer at a church conference. Like I would be super, super uncomfortable doing that. Like I might, if I were single, I might make myself do that because I would think, like, I really should. But I would really hate doing that. On the other hand, if Howard's talking to a single person in the church and just goes ahead and says, "So what's your deal? Do you want to get married? Is there somebody in your life? Do you want to get married?" And if they say, no, I think the Lord's calling me to this, and I'm good with that," then all right. Great, more power to you. We love you, and we'll cherish you in that way. If they say, "Yeah, I really, really want to get married," you know anybody? A story from my wife's family. There was a man, probably in his late 20s, early 30s, in their church in Cambridge, who came to my in-laws and said, "I would really like to get married. So if you know any really godly women that you think might be a good match, please connect us." And they took that to heart. They did. And, 30 years and 8 kids later, they're going strong. And that is a couple that would not have found each other otherwise, and who made an excellent couple. They're tough people. They're good people. They're godly people. Just a power couple. And that did happen through the active matchmaking of not the whole church, and definitely not like a singles event, but it happened through the active care of some brothers and sisters in the Lord.
Well, when I say the church, that's what I mean. Maybe a little part of the church,
yeah.
Maybe this, and not necessarily a formal program. Of
no.
Right. Bonnie's laughing like, no. We don't like the formal programs, so thank you very much. Barry and then Heather.
This is an anecdote. At our congregation in Kokomo, two single sisters asked if they could do a singles conference.
Uh-huh.
I said, "Sure, but I just can't do anything else right now, so you have to do it." They had it for 2 years. They both got married and stuff.
That's... And counterpoint. Yeah, that's really good. Heather?
Related to this, I think this is a really important thing for the church to figure out, too, because there's a good way and a less good way of doing this. One of the things that happens when you send off, you know, students to TFY or they go to the international conference, there's this, again, well-meaning, but this, like, wink, wink, kind of, oh, you know, you're in the end.
Yeah.
It's a little too flippant and light. That happens a lot. And I think this is a serious topic that should be taken with sobriety. And I think that's going to be helpful to the young people going through this.
I'm going to MR, or going to Geneva to get your MRS
degree. Yeah. Again, those kinds of comments and flippant things, I think we just need to be more careful.
So we just need to be careful in the way, I'm trying to sum this up for the recording,
yeah.
But we need to be careful in the way that we talk about matchmaking. We need to be careful in the way that we talk about people finding, young people finding spouses and so on. And do you think that it can be damaging to be?
I think
wink,
there are
wink,
some
nudge,
people
nudge.
That will be like, you know, people are like, oh, you're going to meet somebody, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. That expectation makes them back off
mm-hmm.
more, or it makes them, you know, apprehensive to go to those people for
mm-hmm.
counsel, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So if you feel like doing that, just wait till after they're married.
Right.
And then be like, I knew that was going to happen. And actually, in my experience, the first time I went to an RP International conference was 1996, just before I started at Geneva. And the couple that funded me going there was a couple, my parents didn't have any money at the time, and the couple that sent me there did have that in mind. I don't think they said anything about it, and I did actually meet my wife at that international conference. Now, we didn't start dating right away or anything like that, but that is how it worked out. And they later on, like, didn't, well, there's a lot of stories from here. They weren't usually that discreet and quiet. They tended to loudly try to do matchmaking. I love them anyway.
But they were doing it intentionally when they did. And
mm-hmm.
that's what I'm getting at. You know, this is either intentional or not. This in-between stuff is not helpful.
Yeah, and I think, again, the importance of being straightforward about stuff without being flippant about it. The couple that sent me to this, they're still, you know, they're in their 80s and going strong, and they're absolutely wonderful people. Tough old merchant marine, and, you know, his wife had a really bad or really rough background, and they have been a power couple for the Lord since then, and they've really appreciated that being married allowed them to do that, and so they've just been like, really? You need to get married. I'm going to send you to the, you know, fill in the blank. It's kind of hard to resist that. It's kind of hard not to love that, even though it can make you uncomfortable. But other questions, comments? Doesn't have to be on singleness. It could be on so many other things.
So I was able to go to a conference a few years back that Peter Jones gave, and the Truth Exchange gave, on two loves, and dealing with professing Christians who are openly gay or lesbian, and trying to, I mean, I don't get into an argument with them anymore. It's just like, it's just not scriptural, you know, and I mean, just like with what went around here, and love is love, and just try, it can be very intimidating, and there have been times, like at work, where they're talking, and I don't always butt in. I mean, if I'm asked directly what I think about it, I'll tell them. But it's just very difficult to redirect. But the professing Christians are the ones that I have difficulty engaging in and trying to. I'm not afraid of stepping on toes, but it's just a hard thing to get them to really examine scripture and get out of that. You know, it's like their love for themselves and their feelings is much more important than their love for God and His Word. So it's not a question.
So the hardest folks to engage on issues of same-sex marriage, homosexuality, tend to be people who are professing Christians.
because they just, they've been, and there's so many churches out there, obviously, mm-hmm. that are all with them for it.
Right. You know? Yeah, I came to know a little church in Providence that's entirely made up of gay men. And the funnest thing is they call themselves Catholics.
Very They're funny.
Obviously not in the fellowship of the Roman Catholic Church, but yeah, but those are some of the toughest conversations to have. But I also think, you know, there may be possibilities for, there may be more possibilities there, even though they're the hardest conversations, kind of like with family members. Even though they're the hardest conversations, you may have the most possibility because you have the most common ground. You know, so starting out with scripture, but also, not necessarily going at it as like a frontal assault. Let's find all the verses about homosexuality and argue about those. But the idea, for instance, that we will all face temptation, all of us, and some of those temptations will be years long, decades long, lifelong, hard to deal with, and yet no temptation is overcome or has overtaken you that is not common to mankind, and the Lord will give you a way of escape. The idea of, you know, people fall in love with the wrong person. It happens to married heterosexual people,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
You know, this is not, what you're dealing with is not so fundamentally different from what many other people deal with, and yet they must persist and be obedient in through that temptation as well. And I won't promise you that God's going to straighten you out, as it were. That would be stupid. But I will promise you that if you ask for it, God will give you the grace to persevere in obedience to Him. That I can base in Scripture. Comments, questions? Esther?
One thing I was thinking it might be interesting to talk about is what it looks like for a church to welcome refugees into the sexual world.
Man, yeah, that's a great question. What does it look like for churches to welcome refugees of the sexual revolution? I'm only going to say very brief things on that because I don't think we've done all that much of it. You know, we do have plenty of people in our church who have a checkered past sexually. Most Americans, almost all Americans, have fornicated before marriage, whether they're Christians or not. So that's in there. As far as what that looks like, you know, I was saying to somebody a little while ago, I think the first thing we need to do is establish the expectation that those folks are going to be in our churches, they're going to come to our churches, and that when they come, we are going to be really happy that they're there. I think that sometimes somebody else was, maybe it was Nathan, was saying this, we have this expectation or this hope that sort of like fully formed, well-functioning families are just going to show up at church. And sometimes that does happen. And then it's like, wow, this is really great. And I always think somebody else put a lot of work into these folks, right? Because Christians, in order to be fully formed, well-functioning families, require a lot of help. Somebody, their own families, churches they've been in before, and so on, has worked with them for years and years to help them get there. Well, sometimes we get that. But we shouldn't expect that all the time, and maybe we shouldn't expect that often. We should be expecting people to show up who are carrying a big pile of issues, and then help them, and then humbly help them figure those things out. I mean, we're going to have, you know, women come in who are lesbians. We're going to have men come in who are gay. We're going to have people come in who have already gotten the top and the bottom surgery when they transitioned, and we're going to have to work with that. But I'm not going to make comments on that and try to be an expert, but I would be interested in if anybody has any comments on that from the floor. Like, have you guys, what's it look like for your churches to welcome refugees from the sexual revolution?
These weren't refugees yet, but I have a couple of friends who are a married them and they came. And I was very encouraged when I got there that there was already a plan in place to welcome them. And that meant a lot. And it was simply to make people aware of the situation and to have conversation that led to Christ talking about church in the background and all of that, but without making them be fully formed.
So preparing the church for specific people coming to visit.
And some of that is knowing who to redirect towards other conversations as well.
Yeah.
And some of the PhD folks at bay.
So you're saying not everybody's equally ready to engage in that way.
Engage with those that need a more sensitive engagement. And you're not mature enough yet to talk to these people.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So some people are not, I'm repeating all this for the sake of the recording, but some people are not ready to talk to folks who are coming from a really, really different background. I would say one thing that I think we've been blessed with is the ability to, and I'm talking about my family, is we've been able to expose our children to the kind of folks who are in the world while they're still under our roof. And we can have good conversations about these things. So our kids are part of a city, strings program where it's only for kids from poor neighborhoods, and we count. So they're with kids from a lot of different backgrounds. Our oldest son is in public high school that's extremely, left-wing in its orientation. But he comes home every day. And we get to talk it through. And one time there was a sort of a critical thing happening where he's like texting me, "Dad, Planned Parenthood is running the student assembly. I happen to be walking to work past his school. And I came in and frightened all the secretaries in the school office." And the ability to have to expose your children to the reality, our young kids are going to find out at some point that there are same-sex couples in the world. And they're going to find out at some point that there are men dressed up as women and women dressed up as men. They're going to find out even that they'll go get surgery in order to make their private parts look like the other sex. They're going to find out much better that they find out with you and just be like, "Yeah, we know that's wrong, but we don't hate those people. We love them. And we recognize that sin brings people to make all kinds of bad decisions, and those are some of those bad decisions. And so when those folks show up in our church, we want to welcome them and love them. And when we're outside of our church and we're interacting with them, we want to be friendly and nice to them and love them, even if they get upset because they find out that we're Christians who don't think that what they're doing is okay." That's a tremendous amount of power in that.
My daughter has an older sister who isn't biologically mine from my husband. And one thing that was very hard on my daughter, but it was good for her to learn about it now, was that my stepdaughter is now wanting to transition, and she's 13.
Mm-hmm.
And her mom is very supportive. She was upset for a bit, but she's encouraged this behavior, this girl's whole life. So it's like, you can't hold the standard different for your daughter. So it was really rough when we found out, of course. And I don't know if she's actually going to yet or not, but it gave me a very sobering opportunity to explain to Scarlett what exactly was going on. So, it wasn't the best, and probably not like the...
Mm-hmm.
It's an early age to find out about it, but she's also... Her dad isn't a Christian, so she's also with him sometimes, and she is exposed to certain things. And I found it actually very helpful in a certain way. It's sad, but it's helpful that she's able to learn about this stuff. And then she'll come back to me, and she'll talk to me about it, and we'll talk about it. And she knows that it's wrong, but she's also around a lot of gay people because of that. And she's not, she has no animosity towards them, which I really like. Like, she's aware that it's not right, but I told her to just keep that to herself for now. You know, you don't have to debate with all of your dad's friends about homosexuality. So it is good for her to learn.
Yeah,
that way.
Having, you know, maybe this gets back to some of the singleness discussion we had a little while ago. Having open conversations and just not being afraid of it,
mm-hmm.
is just priceless. It's priceless.
Intimidating sometimes.
It's very intimidating. Of course it's intimidating. And we have a right instinct to protect our children's innocence as much as possible. But we also have to recognize we are raising them to be warriors. We're raising them to do what's right when it's hard, and to represent what's right when it's hard. I had another thought on that, but I don't have any memory, so it's gone. Howard?
Irene and I were involved in a ministry that was dealing primarily with people that were messed up sexually.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very often, and these were Christians, who for the first time would admit some of the things that were going on inside, and sometimes outside.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very hard for them to see the program end, because this was a place where they were accepted, they were understood, they were helped, and they were afraid that they just went back to their normal church. It wasn't going to be there. They were going to be all alone. They're going to be left dangling. They didn't want the program to end. And there was a part of the program that sort of talked about reintegrating into the church. But it was very brief, and it didn't alleviate the fears. But and some of them went back. Some of them lived very exemplary lives. Became a great testimony to the rest of the church. A few of them fell off the truck and just couldn't do it.
So one of the hardest, so what you're saying is that very often one of the hardest things for people is to go into the institutional church as we know it and not feel like they have the safety and support that they might in some settings. And I actually think, so I'm going to throw this out there, and those of you, maybe especially you pastors or elders, can start thinking about this. I actually think we have we're missing out on something that we totally could do and maybe really, really need to do, which is bring back the practice of open confession of sin in the church. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I've been struck by the power and helpfulness. I'm sure somebody's not going to like this, but the power and helpfulness of 12-step programs. AA and programs like that do a tremendous amount of good, in large part because there is a function, there is this environment and this expectation of, I'm just going to be really open with you about, in effect, my sin. I'm going to tell you what I'm struggling with. And you're not going to tell me it's okay to do those things that you did, but you are going to tell me that you love me and you're with me. And we have more resources. That's church light on a certain level. We have more resources for dealing with people's sin. We've had a couple times now in our congregation. I'm sorry. We've had a couple times now in our congregation where people have committed fairly open sin, and they weren't instructed to do this by the session, but they decided that they wanted to make public confession before the church. And far from being some sort of public hate fest, that is an incredibly important moment of catharsis and welcome and public forgiveness. And I really wonder if we're missing something really big. And the unwitting, even though we preach, I think RP churches are very good at preaching, we are sinners saved by grace. We are all in need of constant repentance. we don't make that a public thing, and therefore we give the impression, despite what we're saying, we give the impression that everybody here at least thinks they're fine. If you're dealing with somebody with like a really serious ongoing struggle with sexual temptation, they know they're not fine. And then they're going to church, and they're around people who seem to all be fine, or at least seem to be pretending they're fine, and they either come to the conclusion that I'm just way worse than the rest of these people, or they're a bunch of lying hypocrites. We've got to do better than we have. I don't know what that looks like. Maybe I need to write a paper, and it'll get examined by the Synod in 17 years or so. But we do have to do better about being honest about our sins without turning it into a contest to see who has the most extravagant sins, which does happen in some places.
Or a witch hunt.
Or a witch hunt.
Yeah, along the lines of the witch hunt thing, there's, I think, a temptation to set sexual sin aside as the unforgivable sin, kind of the ultimate sin, and I think there are other sins that are heinous to God.
Like pride.
Yeah. There you go. And and one of the things that I got out of that, working with that ministry, was that when you get down to the underlying sins that cause those sins on the surface, they're pretty much all the same. So Satan has just a small number of ingredients to work with, and they cooks up, or we do in our own flesh, different ways that it exhibits itself. So to set ourselves apart as somehow being more holy than these people over here is, well, like you say, not a healthy environment.
I think we have the tools. I don't think like the Christian church is just fundamentally unable to deal with this stuff. I think in some ways it's just a matter of dusting those things off. I mean, we're like, this is the little weird denomination that Rosaria Butterfield came from. Nobody likes us anyway. Guys, we have nothing to lose here in being as faithful to Christ as we can, in being even a little weirder. And I think you're, and we don't, we absolutely, you know, veneer of slickness and coolness. RP churches don't have a veneer of slickness and coolness already. Veneer of sinlessness? Only sometimes. I don't think it's a big leap for us to say we refuse to be places where those refugees from the revolution come and are just condemned all over the place. Nathan?
Yeah, transitioning a bit.
Too soon.
Going back to Proverbs 31. I'm not going in that direction. Going back to Proverbs 31, I've seen in my time in the pastorate that Proverbs 31 is sometimes looked at like what did you call it?
A stick to beat Christian women with.
Okay.
Yeah.
So sometimes it seems to be just pushed aside as something that is archaic and old-fashioned.
And unattainable.
And then the other extreme is like the modern application is like, the denim jumper in Ked's homeschool band. No offense to homeschool band people. But
you're
not,
one kid away from a homeschool van.
We have a roof rack. So how can we as pastors and maybe even a two-part, how can we as men that don't really have a right, so to speak, in our culture to have a voice towards this being a glorious thing, how do we promote this? And then how can women in the church see this not as, the proverb of oppression, but really one of liberation? Can you just talk about that a little bit?
So the question is, how can we make good use of Proverbs 31?
How can we make Proverbs 31 great again?
How can we make Proverbs 31 great again? I actually think that it repays careful reading tremendously. Proverbs 31 does not, and I remember preaching on this a while back, and I said, the woman of Proverbs 31 is not, you know, a desperate housewife of ancient Jerusalem, right? She's not ornamental. She's not waiting for, you know, dolled up, waiting for her husband to get home, because, you know, she's just there to look good on his arm and be fun for him in the after hours. Nor is she, and, you know, it's interesting, there are children in there, but she's not defined in terms of just bearing a huge number of children. That's actually not the primary thing that's focused on. She's also not a 21st century career woman who is like clawing her way to the top of a Fortune 500 company. She is emphatically a worker and a provider, but she's a home-centered worker and provider. And that it winds up painting this incredibly full-orbed picture of her work. She's an investor. She's a long-term thinker. She laughs at the time to come, right? She laughs at the future. She provides clothing and food for her children and her servants. She does business with the local merchants. She makes money for the household. And I don't remember if I touched on this or if it's in tomorrow's a little bit, but the phrase that gets repeated is, give her the fruit of her hands. And I've thought about that for years, and what give her the fruit of her hands means. Because I think you could read it as in on one level as, let her keep all the income that she makes. And sometimes that happens. My grandmother did that in an unhealthy way. She kept all the income she made and never contributed to the family well-being, even though my grandfather was racking up debts in order to keep his family alive. I think that could be a really unhealthy thing, but I actually think I've come to the conclusion it's a better version of live on one income. So Elizabeth Warren, you guys know that name?
Yep.
Running for president. Did you know that she wrote a book called The Two-Income Trap back in the 1990s? Do you know about this? Raise your hand if you know about this book. It's a great book. It really is. And one of the things she talks about is how living on two incomes makes families fragile, because you peg your lifestyle to the two incomes, and then if something happens, it's going to destroy your family. You know, if somebody is out of work or gets disabled or something, you're in big trouble. Whereas a one-income family, if something happens to the husband's income, for instance, the wife has the capacity to go to work and the family's not destroyed. Exactly that happened in my family when I was growing up. My father lost his factory job. My mom went and got a different factory job, and we were okay. I think that when you're looking at give her the fruit of her hands, I think it is saying on some level, allow her to retain the financial wealth that she's making in order to continue to reinvest it, but it's never for her selfish purposes. You are together building a life. There's so much in there that if you pay attention to it, and then if you step back and just see that the Proverbs 31 woman is the avatar of wisdom and is an emblem of the Church of Christ in the world, then we should all be super, seriously, I think we should all be really excited about that passage of Scripture. It's very far from being a stick to beat people up with.
And it seems that sometimes it's scoffed at, you know, that you hear people and then they just do a, you know, like it's a joke or something. And, you know, I think it is a beautiful thing. And, you know, it's not even just female-centric in a way. You know, the husband is in the chapter.
Right.
And he's a leader in the community.
Right.
You know, so it's not an elevating of the woman to something unattainable, and the husband is like in the basement playing Nintendo.
Right.
He's an elder in the gates, debating and governing and ruling in the best sense of the term. So it's sort of the best image of biblical marriage in a lot of ways. mean, I remember when we were, Lydia and I were in college, and, you know, I had all of these roommates, and one of my roommates, whenever rent came due, he was selling everything he could to pay rent because he never worked. And he was always talking about this Proverbs 31 woman that he's going to get. And I remember my wife, wasn't my wife at the time, but she's kind of feisty, if you guys didn't figure it out. She said to him, if you would start focusing on what you need to do and stop focusing on what a Christian woman needs to do, maybe you would find this wife. You know, he kind of melted before her and tried to marry her.
I do think that's right. And think about the placement. So think about the placement of Proverbs 31 at the end of the book.
Yeah.
So over and over again, the twits, the male twits who read this book have been pushed away from their tendency to laziness and sexual sin and toward wisdom and toward wisdom and toward wisdom. And it's almost laid out as a, if this is the kind of man you seek to be, maybe you will have this kind of a wife.
Yeah.
This is a gift from the Lord. And this is, I've spent 30 chapters plus focusing on what the men are to be, right? Because it is addressed to my son over again. Not that it's not for women as well, but it's particularly focused on men. Spent 30 chapters plus focusing on what this is to be. If you embrace wisdom, this is what is before you. And one thing I've said in some private conversations that's very interesting is in Proverbs, there's a sense in which women are called to embody wisdom. Men are called to embrace wisdom. There's a difference there. I'm not sure how to put my finger on it beyond that. But the men are given the choice. You can either embrace the strange woman who is the avatar of folly, or you can embrace the excellent wife who is the avatar of wisdom. And to embrace wisdom brings you to the excellent wife, and to embrace the excellent wife brings you to wisdom. And the same thing happens in reverse with the strange woman. Barry?
I was just going to say that she's wisdom embodied.
Exactly.
And that's, if we're going to reach this culture, they need to see this kind of a home. You know, it's one thing to have it in the church, but we also have to have it in the home. And so often, it's coming into homes and seeing these kinds of relationships of wisdom embodied that's that great draw, that great power to overcome all these false ideologies.
I think one of the cool things, I think about the church sometimes, and I think, really, I really like women. I don't know if you picked up on that. I like my wife, but I like women in general. And I admire women in general, and I especially admire Christian women. And I sometimes think of Christian churches as like this closet full of gold. But when you come in and you see, I remember thinking, who wouldn't want to be a Christian man? I see all of these incredible, incredible wives that these guys wind up marrying. What an attractive thing for the world to get, if they get a glimpse of the family lives of believers, of serious believers. What an inherently attractive thing. I see many women who embody wisdom in Christian churches. And it's incredibly encouraging to me. It's incredibly, and I think it's incredibly attractive to the world around us. I thought I saw a hand from over here. Yes, no. We're getting up close to our time, but we don't have to use it all up. Any other questions, comments?
You were talking during your talk about how it's not hard for men to respect women, but it's hard for women to respect men, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly what she said, but this is played out so often in the media, and it's really disgusting. So you think of every sitcom out there, of family sitcom, and there's this strong, funny, great woman and this doofus of a father that's just cut down. And I really appreciate that today, you know, there's been an encouragement to women to be strong, to be this Proverbs 31 woman who's a hard worker and respected and things like that. But I think it's an important message to young women particularly, but anyone, to elevate, to push up the men in our lives.
Not to mention the children ridiculing.
Oh, yeah.
Parents in general, and fathers in particular.
Right, so I think it's just really important for women to not focus so much on being that strong woman, but being part of the community to lift up all those around us. And yeah, that's all. I just think it's very important.
Gary?
Well, I think a lot of it might have to do with how we measure success nowadays. I look at a family like Nathan's family and Ryan Hemphill's family, and the women in those families, they homeschool their children are very well behaved, and we don't think that that's a success in this society anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that's a big problem, because that's a huge success, is how they raise their children and how they love the Lord and you know, how they're homeschooled and how they love other children. And you can see it out there when they're playing. They're so respectful of other people. And I think that we've kind of lost that a little bit, you know, because Lydia's job is very, and Alicia's job is very, probably even harder than Nathan's job. You know, raising those children and homeschooling them and having to be polite. And I think we've lost that. You know, that's because that's a success.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And we'll hopefully I put something in there about children and the courage to be a mother. we'll get into that a little bit tomorrow, but you're absolutely right, and that gets back to that idea that the modern world respects money or money-making activity and doesn't really respect anything else.
And
right?
Both genders are guilty of it.
And both genders are guilty of it. Absolutely right. All right, folks, any other? Mark, go for it.
Comment. Just thinking about men and women, you know, men and women come from boys and girls, obviously, and one thing I've noticed is a rightful emphasis on the capabilities and opportunities for young girls and women. What seems to be forgotten and almost denigrated is the capabilities and opportunities for young boys to grow. The local TV station San Diego once a week or so has, you know, a spot for this program or that program for young women, but rarely, if ever, for young boys. And so if what we're talking about in this whole issue is how do we raise up godly people, how do we become godly people as adults, and I'm just throwing this out for us to remember, we have to be thinking about how do we raise godly young girls, how do we raise godly young men. If men are going to grow from boys, then the sins that men incline to are in seed form in the boys. How do we go about helping them to recognize those temptations? How do we go about guiding them away from them into a proper Christian manhood in obedience to Him? I just want to remind us of that.
Thank you for reminding us of that. And there's no way we can have that discussion right now, because that's a whole other, whole huge thing. I would only say one thing, and this gets back to what I was talking about yesterday. When you see young women being praised at the expense of young men for things that young men have traditionally done or specialized in, you're seeing, it's not just an attempt to it's not merely an attempt to raise women up above men, it's an attempt to make women into men. That's ugly. Bonnie?
Nothing. And the whole thing of not just teaching men and young women value the trades. I mean, like I say, everybody's not called to go to college. And
right.
Believe me, John, his mechanical abilities and his painting ability, you know, I mean, those are invaluable. money savers, actually, but just to teach men and young girls alike that, I mean, your husband doesn't have to be some kind of a college graduate professor or whatever. I mean, a hard worker. I mean, and the farmers and the, you know, I mean, all of that is so valuable, and society doesn't respect that much either until they complain about the price they have to pay for their car to get fixed or their plumbing to be, you know.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. All right, everybody. Have a great... Don't go very far. Barry York's going to be speaking in a couple minutes.
Oh.
Ryan, would you go ahead and announce it? I think you can get up and move around.